welcome to SSI Live. You've long known the Strategic Studies Institute, or SSI, at the U.S. Army War College as the go-to location for issues related to national security and military strategy, with an emphasis on geostrategic analysis. SSI conducts strategic research and analysis to support the U.S. Army War College curricula, assist and inform Army, DoD, and U.S. government leadership, and serve as a bridge to the wider strategic community. Now we're bringing you access to SSI analyses, scholars, and guests through this, the SSI Live podcast series. Thanks for joining us. Hello and welcome to this edition of SSI Live. My name is John Denny, and I'm a research professor of National Security Studies here at SSI. It's Wednesday, April 24th, 2024, and today I'm joined by my SSI colleague, Dr. Tony Pfaff. Tony is a research professor for strategy, the military profession, and ethics, and he's recently published a book entitled Proxy War Ethics, The Norms of Partnering in Great Power Competition, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Now, given the unfolding wars in Ukraine and Gaza, both of which have seen proxy activity, or at least something that looks a lot like proxy activity, I've asked Tony to talk to us today about his very timely book. Tony, welcome.
Thank you, John. Very glad to be here.
Now, Tony, I know that in your book, you begin by taking a look back historically at the role of proxies. As you look back across history, is it your sense that proxy relationships are proliferating? Do you think they're becoming more or maybe less common in international relations?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I think the reason I have the history chapters is because I think you don't really understand a problem until you understand the history of the problem. Now, in terms of whether or not it's proliferating, I don't know. I don't think they're more or less likely, but I think whether they're more or less likely is a function of their utility, and their utility is a function of the global order. So in a bipolar order, like you saw in the Peloponnesus so many years ago, or in the Cold War, particularly when the superpowers don't, you know, view conflict between themselves as their worst case, which arguably they do more in the Cold War than in Peloponnesus, there's a lot of pressure to gain advantage by engaging proxies and getting proxies to do the fighting for you. And to help you maintain, you know, that power power balance in your favor. And that places a lot of pressure on states or actors who would otherwise be not aligned to align. And you saw that in, you certainly saw that between Athens and Sparta, where Athens didn't want to come to the defense of Corcyra, for example, but it really didn't feel like it had a choice because Corcyra had the second largest navy. And if it aligned with the Spartans, that would effectively negate Athens' advantage. An example of getting a war that nobody really wanted. There's a lot of Cold War examples that we could talk about as we go along, like the Angolan Civil War, which, you know, was a very much a function of a botched transition from, you know, from colonial rule to self-rule, where the Soviet Union and the United States saw opportunities, and those opportunities led to one of the longest civil wars that I think, you know, in world history. So the order matters. We can talk a little bit more if you're interested about how that matters. But these days it may not exactly. It's certainly not the bipolar order of the Cold War, but it is. But whether or not it's multipolar or what I call or polyarchic, which I'm borrowing a term from a scholar named Sion Brown. You're certainly seeing a great deal of utility in these relationships, particularly for regionally weaker actors.
Well, let's layer on top of this now what you've outlined historically, the issue of ethics in proxy warfare. When do moral hazards arise in these kinds of relationships? Are they present from the get-go, given the lack of complete control often characterizing a sponsor-proxy relationship? Or do they kind of evolve as part of the relationship over time as it unfolds?
The short answer is, of course, yes, and it depends. No, I think the conditions for the hazards are inherent in the structure of the proxy relationship. So, you know, where you have a indirect, you know, when you have a proxy relationship is a kind of principal agent relationship where A principal provides support to an agent, then the principal may not always know exactly what the agent is doing in terms of how it's getting, you know, how it's doing the thing that the principal wants. The agent may not, you know what, how steadfast, for example, that the principal is going to be in continuing that support. So in that sense, it's different than, you know, an alliance or a partnership, which I cover those structures in the book as well. But in these kinds of relationships, I think the kinds of moral hazards that I talk about, where interests can become misaligned, where you risk either sponsor or proxy underestimating the costs of the intervention or of the relationship, and thus initiating a sequence of events leading to war that may not have otherwise happened, and diffusion, where all that sponsor support doesn't necessarily go for the good that was intended, and obviously escalation, which we're seeing today, particularly in, you know, Iran's use of proxies in the Middle East. And then finally, dirty hands, where your proxies don't exactly share the same values you might, or they may not be able in many cases to fight in accordance with the law of armed conflict, and thus place you in a position where you're tainted by their actions. So I think all of those are inherent in those relationships. Now, whether or not they manifest does depend. And this is kind of the point of the book. There's moral challenges. There's things you have to address before the relationship can be, you know, morally permissible. But even when it's morally permissible, these are the challenges that you have to address, you know, as you're going along, because they'll manifest in different ways at different times as the, you know, relationship evolves.
You know, I have the sense from what you've just said that the moral hazards are really almost by definition a part of such relationships, or they can be. Do they ever tail off or fade over time, or do they only end when the conflict or crisis that spawned the relationship in the first place ends?
Yeah, no, good question. I would say they're certainly latent in the relationship. Whether or not they manifest, you know, depends on individual certain circumstances. Now, so the idea that your interests may misalign, and so for instance, you know, that probably goes once the relationship is ended, then there's, you know, little chance of there's no concern about any future misalignment. However, having said that, and obviously concerns about escalation once the relationship has ended has probably also been diminished, depending on how the terms of how it ended. But things that you need to be concerned about that don't end, I think, are like diffusion. So, for instance, the United States provided stingers to Afghan rebels for several years in the 80s. They were found in dozens of other countries over the next, you know, several years, which the U.S. tried to buy back, but only got, you know, a small portion of them. So that kept going. That was a gift that kept on giving. Also, under diffusion, you'll see crime rates in a lot of these areas increase because, you know, there's just more weapons and ammunition and other, you know, military, you know, materiel that can fuel internal conflicts or spill over into. And so that can keep on giving even after the relationship has ended. So and then finally, dirty hands. That kind of tank can last for a very long time, as we've seen, like, you know, also, you know, our Cold War relationships, you know, they're still, you know, in many ways, we're still paying the price for that.
So let's unpack now the norms that govern this. What can be done? Well, first of all, what kind of norms exist to govern these relationships? Are there any? Are there just sort of, to what extent is international law or convention and practice govern these relationships?
Yeah, no. I think that's an important question, because the short answer is they're very thin. And I would argue not only inadequate to govern the kinds of relations, you know, the kinds of activity we're seeing these days, they actually undermine an interest in governing it. So there's primarily two standards. One derives from the International Courts of Justice judgment against the United States in the case Nicaragua brought to it following our support for Contras. You know, the Contras engaged in activity that would be a violation of the law of armed conflict, That was part of the case. The International Court of Justice says, well, the sponsor, in this case, the United States, would only be accountable or responsible if it had effective control. And it defined effective control as an organ of the state or that actor instructing the recipient, the benefit, the proxy. They didn't use that language, obviously, but to do the bad act. Since that didn't happen, the United States was found not responsible for what the Contras were doing, even though the someone on the support team had provided the Contras a manual that specified some of those acts as being useful to do. Interestingly, I learned when I was researching the book that manual was actually a response to trying to address many of the ethical concerns that the Contras were raising, and to make them more and to kind of rein them in a little bit. There was basically a fundamental misunderstanding, from what I can tell, regarding what discrimination is all about. That made that kind of a fiasco. So that's effective control. Then with that judgment in mind, there was the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia that was dealing with the aftermath of Serbian militias and militants, attacks against Bosnians. And in this case, they said, well, they applied a standard called overall control. And overall control was a standard where it looked at emphasized the relationship between the organizations, and it held that the Federal Republic of Yugoslav's army had effective control over the Serbians because they shared similar officers, they paid salaries, they provided logistical support, and they helped with planning. But essentially that's a standard that says, no, they're not really a proxy. they're one of you. The sponsor is disincentivized to rein in proxies because any effort to do so risks being held accountable for it. And the other one tries to get rid of the problem by, basically assuming it away or defining it away. Either way, you're not actors. Sponsors are not incentivized to provide a lot of control because that's more likely to make them accountable. So the last thing that you could appeal to is there's the UN brokered arms trade treaty that we actually, the United States, we're not signatories, but we had a big hand in drafting it. The only problem with that is that, we're not a signatory. Russia's not a signatory. Iran's not a signatory. And even countries that are signatories, there's not been a lot of enforcement. But that could be that could be something which, if more countries got behind it, it could be a more robust tool for at least regulating arms flows.
Well, that leads me to my next question for you, Tony, and that is, if these norms of behavior or the rules, if we can even call them that, are so thin, how can we strengthen them? What can we do to mitigate the worst outcomes of these proxy relationships?
There are a number of things we can do, it'll certainly be a long road, particularly because lots of actors, both good and both for good and ill, make use of these kinds of relationships. So any kind of normative regime would have to be able to accommodate. The idea is not to rule out or get rid of proxy relationships. It's just to bring them. Is to provide some level of expectations and governance that prevents the hazards from occurring, and it allows and incentivizes actors to actually, particularly sponsors, to exert the kind of control they need to. So that's the first thing, is look at ways to understand or interpret the current set of norms that gets around that sort of dysfunctional incentive of avoiding control, of just providing support and walking away. To do that, you're going to have to strengthen expectations that once you provide support, you're in some way accountable for what happens with it. Now that may not mean that now you're, if it's misused, that the sponsor then is, bears necessarily some penalty. So for example, take the problem of dirty hands. you know, we provided the Iraqis a lot of support in their fight against ISIS. There were a number of occasions where Iraqi soldiers did not treat ISIS detainees very well, and certainly in violation of the Larim conflict. Do we walk away from that? Well, if we do, then we still have the Islamic State occupying, northern Iraq and southern Syria, and all the atrocities that that brings with it. And so what I'd like to see is, in those circumstances, you know, an expectation that is enforceable in some way, that the sponsor then must take some sort of action to get whatever the wrongdoing is to stop, hold the individuals accountable, and place that, you know, sponsored party on a path to avoiding that kind of behavior in the future. Now, when it comes to the relation, you know, at the higher level, when it comes to relationships themselves, I think we need to create an expectation, and it'll be informal at first, that certain conditions need to be met before you provide support. And I talk about what those are in the book, obviously. And then your responsibilities for continuing to manage relationship after it starts. There's no walking, you know, that walking away really isn't an option. And how do you do that? Well, you've got to build consensus. That consensus can turn into practice. And then over time, that practice can turn into, you know, customary international law. But that's going to take a lot of political will and a lot of friends helping us with it.
Speaking of friends getting help, let's bring this now into current events, what we see unfolding right now in Ukraine and in Gaza. Given what you've researched and your findings and the recommendations, what would you recommend to policymakers? How would they apply the kinds of things that that you're speaking of or writing of in this book to the situation regarding Western support for Ukraine? Now, we don't call that a proxy war, right? We're very clear about that. But it has the appearance to some of being this kind of a conflict. So what would you recommend with regard to that war? And then what would you recommend with regard to Israel's role in Gaza right now?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And this is maybe where the podcast may go a little off the rails, but I'll do my best to keep him on. So the first thing that I want to say is, yes, I can understand the utility in not characterizing something as a, in a relationship as a proxy relationship, but it's also, this isn't necessarily an all or nothing kind of designation. These are features of a structured relationships that, you know, can be part of other kinds of relationships to more or less degrees, to more or less differing degrees. However, I think you can say in the case of Ukraine, we're certainly supporting them. This is not the all for one for all kind of relationship. Everyone's facing a common threat, and a common threat in the same way that you see in an alliance. And this is where you can talk about, you know, the difference between shared interest and misaligned and aligned interests. So we certainly share an interest in containing Russian aggression. But they're not necessarily aligned, because we're probably not willing to pay the same cost to do that that the Ukrainians are. And it's in that gap that you see it arises the first hazard, which is misaligned interest, you know, leading to what I've been calling rational betrayal. It's rational because, you know, really, you get yourself in the situation where it's the it's the best way forward, but it comes at, you know, a pretty high moral cost. Or maybe the best way forward. And the idea there is you want to avoid being in that position in the first place. So what I would say there is to understand, once you've engaged in the supporting in a supporting relationship, that changes. You know, you can't just rewind the clock and just say, oh, it was a mistake, we're going to stop. You incur obligations. You've changed the game. You've created a possibility that didn't previously exist. And that possibility is that the actor you are sponsoring and the people you are sponsoring can be in a position, you know, are fighting a war they may not have fought otherwise, but end up with the same kind of defeat, just at a higher cost. To the extent you play a role in creating that possibility, you bear some responsibility in avoiding it or mitigating that outcome. So that would be one thing I'd point out to, you know, those worried about who, what, when, why, and how we, you know, support Ukraine. And doesn't, but don't get me wrong, it doesn't mean that there's a blank check. And what the, you know, what the, you know, supported actor, you know, does, you know, should affect support. And we should talk, we should discuss things like reasonable chance of success and other conditions of, you know, just war thinking that, you know, that may inform what may be a better outcome. So, but as the sponsor, you take on the responsibility to have that conversation and to help the proxy, in this case, we're going to use that designation, find, you know, the best alternative, you know, the best outcome that it can. And that's the subject of my next monograph. So which should be out here soon. So I'll pause that there. And I'll pause here if you had any follow-ups, or I can talk about Israel and Gaza.
Well, yeah, let's turn to Israel and Gaza. Do you think that that sound? I mean, what you just outlined sounds like it applies to all these cases, right? But in the case of Israel, it seems to me this is, gosh, the moral hazards are far more acute right now.
Well, I mean, for whom? And this is where we're going to go a little off the. You know, every supported relationship, I mean, for this isn't necessarily a proxy relationship. Supporting, and I don't think. I don't think the current relationship with Israel really is a proxy relationship. You know, we're not, you know, Hamas is not really a threat by itself to the United States. So, you know, we're not getting indirect benefit by the defeat of Hamas. That doesn't mean we shouldn't support them. But it just makes it more of a pretty standard, you know, coming to the defense of another. Partnership, if not alliance, and that just depends on where you the role you think of a formal relation. You know, a lot of theories on alliances require them to be formal. You know, in terms of there is a, you know, a written document. I'm not sure that's here, so we'll call it a partnership. I'm not sure. Now you might say, well, we're getting this indirect benefit of them containing Iran. Maybe, and that might be where you can make an argument. There are some proxy aspects to it. But then my point would be most of our concern with Iranian proxies is in Iraq and Syria and this fighting in Gaza. Fighting them in Gaza is not, you know, really helping us with that. So we're not getting a benefit direct or, you know, indirect or, other, you know, indirectly or directly. So I don't think the conditions there for really for it being a proxy relationship. So a lot of that means a lot of the hazards aren't present. Doesn't mean none of them are. I mean, you still worry about how they're going to use the support you do provide. That endures. And I would say what's useful about the proxy framework is that even if you don't think of it as a proxy, it still identifies certain potentials in the other kinds of relationships that you might have that you still need to manage and you still need to govern. Now, what you are seeing is for Iran's part, you are seeing their use of proxies risking escalation. You know, not too long ago, Kitab Hezbollah, an Iraqi proxy, attacked an outpost in Jordan, killing 3 American soldiers. You know, immediately after that, Kitab Hezbollah issued a statement basically saying Iran didn't know anything about it. They will not retaliate if there is retaliation. They are going to cease those kinds of attacks. And I read that as somebody was getting a little too far ahead of themselves. They had to get reined in lest they risk an escalation that, you know, that Tehran didn't want. So again, I think this framework is useful in both cases for identifying, the kinds of things that, you need to worry about or pay attention to, you know, your adversary and what they need to worry about and how their use of proxies can set conditions for escalatory spirals and other bad outcomes that, you know, with a better normative regime, we might be able to avoid or at least mitigate.
Well, Tony, I can't imagine a more timely book given what's unfolding in world affairs right now. The publication again, the book again, listeners, is Proxy War Ethics, The Norms of Partnering in Great Power Competition, available now for purchase from Palgrave Macmillan. Tony Pfaff, research professor here at SSI, thanks again for joining me today.
Thank you, John. This was a lot of fun.
You can now find SSI Live on TuneIn Radio and on popular podcast directories like Stitcher and at the iTunes Store. If you have any comments on our podcasts, thoughts on what you'd like to see addressed, or a response to something you heard here at SSI Live, please go to our website That's ssi.armywarcollege.edu. Find me, John Denny, in the staff directory, and send me an email. I look forward to hearing from you. For the SSI Live podcast series, I'm John Denny. Thanks for listening.